Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Scripture reading this morning comes from Exodus 14, 21 through 31. Exodus 14, 21 through 31. Then Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the Lord opened up a path through the water with a strong east wind. The wind blew all that night, turning the seabed into dry land. So the people of Israel walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground with walls of water on each side. Then the Egyptians, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and charioteers chased them into the middle of the sea. But just before dawn, the Lord looked down on the Egyptian army from the pillar of fire and cloud and threw their forces into total confusion. He twisted their chariot wheels, making their chariots difficult to drive. "Let's get out of here, away from the Israelites," the Egyptians shouted. "The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. When all the Israelites had reached the other side, the Lord said to Moses, "Raise your hands over the sea again, then the waters will rush back and cover the Egyptians and their chariots and charioteers." So as the sun began to rise, Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the water rushed back into the usual place. The Egyptians tried to escape, but the Lord swept them into the sea. Then the waters returned and covered all the chariots and charioteers, the entire army of Pharaoh, of all the Egyptians who had chased the Israelites into the sea. Not a single one survived. But the people of Israel had walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground as the water stood up like a wall on both sides. That is how the Lord rescued Israel from the hand of the Egyptians that day, and the Israelites saw the bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the seashore. When the people of Israel saw the mighty power that the Lord had unleashed on the Egyptians, they were filled with awe before him. They put their faith in the Lord and in his servant Moses.
As we've been thinking about faith this year, we've looked at various passages of Scripture each month to sort of help us in our focus. This has been ours for the month of May. And so if you would, let's all say this together. I have chosen the way of faithfulness. I set your rules before me. Psalm 119:30. We'll continue to remember that, and it's especially appropriate as we think about the passage that we just read together. In her book describing what the experience of losing her husband was like, Lynn Cain gave an expression that I've found to be very poignant over the years to describe her grief. In a book called Widow, Lynn Cain described what it was like to receive the news that her husband had passed away, to deal with that with her family and with her friends. But she said one particular phrase that stands out to me. She said that dealing with grief is like living in a country where no one speaks your language. Now, chances are, if we think back to times in our life where we've dealt with grief, we know what that feeling is like. Being in a place where no one really speaks your language, you can't really communicate what you're dealing with. There are all kinds of emotions that are swirling around you, and then someone asks you how you're doing, and you say something, you try to put words together, but even as you say it, you realize that's not really representative of what you're feeling. It's hard to put that into words. And then people, friends that you love, mean well, but they don't know what to say either because it's hard to communicate in that kind of language. And so they say some of the same things we've heard said over and over again. And it comes from a place of love, and it comes from a place of wanting to help. But sometimes we struggle to know exactly how to do that. It's hard to live in a country where no one speaks your language. If you've dealt with a language barrier before, you know how challenging that can be. To try to communicate something but realize the person standing on the other end of the conversation doesn't know what you're trying to say. I can remember the first time I ever had the privilege, the chance to be on a trip to another country. We were with our college chorus group, we were in Belgium. We were getting ready for a great week there, and we met and worshiped with the church in Verviers, Belgium. And after worship, we were trying to talk to some of the people there who were obviously wanting to welcome us, but we didn't have translators with us, and it was hard to communicate. And I remember standing across from one individual, and he looked at me, and he said, American. And I said, yes. I nodded, you know, just in case the yes didn't go through. He said, English. And I said, yes. And then we both stood there because neither of us knew exactly what to say. And then his eyes lit up, and I thought, okay, he's remembered some English that he's learned along the way. And he said, cheeseburger. And I said, yes. Apparently he thought that's what Americans want to talk about. They want to talk about cheeseburgers. I said, yes, that's true. It's hard to be in a place where no one speaks your language. But that was evident even a few years later. You've probably been, if you've been on mission trips before, you've been involved with the work that churches all over are doing with children's homes and dealing with orphans. And it was in one of those orphanages in Ukraine, for the first time I was trying to have conversations and to sort of interact with these children there, some of whom did not have parents, some of whom had their parents drop them off there and leave them. And I'll never forget the experiences of having these children, these 8, 9, 10-year-old children, try to communicate something to me and seeing the look in their eyes that this is desperate, this is important. Of course, it could have been something just that was happening that day, a story that they'd been talking with their friends about, but it might have been something really important from their life. And we had translators with us, but not enough to be with us every time. And that feeling of just seeing they had something that they wanted to express, and I wanted to encourage them, but it was hard to do it. It's hard to be in a place where no one speaks your language. And so it's interesting to me that as we look through the pages of Scripture, if there's one thing that becomes very clear, it's that there is no language that exists on earth that God doesn't speak. And not only is Scripture itself inspired by God and recorded in multiple languages, in Hebrew in the Old Testament, and some Aramaic here and there, Greek in the New Testament. But also when we flip through the pages of Acts, we see that one of the ways God would make sure people knew a message was from Him is through this miraculous ability to speak in tongues. For people who had never been trained in a certain language or hadn't grown up in that area, to be able to speak in that language. And it wasn't just to impress people, it was to let them know this message is from God. How do I know it's from God? Because there's no language that God doesn't speak. Even when we start thinking metaphorically, and we start looking at grief as a language, we can know that God speaks that language as well. When the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 53 would describe the servant of the Lord, who we later see parallels with and connections with, and find out that servant of the Lord is pointing to Jesus. He describes him as a man of sorrows, who's acquainted with grief. I don't have to look very long at Jesus' life to see what betrayal occurs, what pain, physical pain, and then a more spiritual element that I can't fully understand occurs as Jesus is on the cross. After he has spent that time in the garden sweating as if drops of blood, God knows what grief is like. And so if I feel like this morning I'm speaking a language that not everybody can understand, God can. And one of the ways we know that is because God gave us Scripture and He gave us the Psalms. There are many different Psalms that remind us of what it's like when people who follow God are struggling with grief. And I think it's an indication that God knows we're going to need words sometimes to express our grief and challenges and not knowing where to turn. And so if you've already opened to Exodus 14, I hope you'll put a bookmark there, put a finger there, but also flip over in the Old Testament to Psalm 77. Because in the 77th Psalm, we have one of those indications that people who are following God, a psalmist, in this case Asaph, following God, is wanting to focus on how to navigate through grief, how to navigate through confusion, how to navigate through this feeling that he doesn't understand God's presence. He's reaching for Him, not sure what's happening. And what he does is think back to the passage that we just read, to this incredible moment where God leads His people of Israel through the waters of the Red Sea. And so what I'd like for us to do this morning, we've been going through Hebrews chapter 11, and that's brought us to Moses' life. And we've looked at the various aspects that the Hebrews author points out, but one of those was walking through the Red Sea, being led by God. And I want us to think specifically this morning about how we can understand that not only as the story for Israelites, but in a very real way as our story too. We're not Israelites, we weren't there, but we are God's people, and the same God who led them leads us. Look at the way the psalmist put it in Psalm 77. Beginning in verse 11, after several verses describing confusion and pain, I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and muse on your deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your strength among the peoples. You have, by your power, redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you. They were in anguish. The deeps also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth a sound. Your arrows flashed here and there. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind, and the lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, and your paths in the mighty waters, and your footprints may not be known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. There are times in life when we feel like we're surrounded with waters that are very turbulent. And while there are some psalms that almost seem like a peaceful spring afternoon where the wind is blowing and there is shade that we can sit under and we can look over a calm, peaceful lake, some of the psalms feel like the psalmist is in the midst of roaring waters. And so in the middle of this time, it's fitting that Psalm 77 would point towards God's deliverance through waters. God's deliverance through a turbulent time where the Israelites felt surrounded with enemies pressing in and water right in front of them. God navigated them through the sea. And so this morning, I want us to think of just a few elements of Exodus 14. That if we can hold on to those, and if we can take those principles and apply those in our lives, when we're in the middle of that turbulent kind of time, God will give us some guidance and some assurance. And we find that in Scripture. And so we begin in Exodus 14 by thinking of where we should focus. What do we do when we're in the middle of rough waters? What do we do when we feel surrounded by enemies on every side? The first is a focus that God needed to remind Israel of, and that is to focus on God's power. You can imagine what it would be like if you were the people of Israel. You'd been enslaved for so many years. Now Moses has shown up, and he's here from God, and God has sent these plagues, one right after another, that are a direct challenge, Exodus 12, verse 12 says, to the gods of Egypt. The true God is showing that He's more powerful than any of the pagan gods that they served. And He has mastery over the elements that they thought were so important, like the Nile River, or like livestock. God is the one who's in control. Who controls when frogs or grasshoppers or locusts show up? God is in control. And so finally, after the Passover, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, we have God's people being delivered from Egypt. But then Pharaoh and the Egyptians sort of come to their senses. It's almost like the shock wears off. They realize what they've done, all the labor that's been lost. And so they decide, we're going to go after them. Now again, if you've been enslaved and you turn and see your former masters coming after you, and keep in mind, Israel might have been large in number, but they were not a trained army. They were not individuals that had experience with battle plan and strategy. And now they see their former captors pressing in on them. And the idea is either they're going to kill us or they're going to take us back as slaves. Now it's going to be even worse than before. And so they were tempted to focus on their enemies. When we focus on our enemies, we are going to feel overwhelmed. Egypt was a world power. The Israelites were a large group, but a group of slaves. So they instinctively respond. Notice what they do. If you're in chapter 14, if you want to go back just a few verses, notice what they say in verse 11 to Moses when they see the enemy coming. They said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." You ever had that experience where you had something that was a good idea, and you had a friend with you who also thought it was a good idea, but then when things start to go wrong, your friend says, "You know, I told you this would never work. I told you this wasn't going to happen." It seems to be what happens here. In fact, if we go back a few chapters earlier, in Exodus chapter 4, when Moses first comes to Israel and tells them what God revealed to him in the burning bush and the mission that God has sent him on, the end of that chapter tells us that they believed in the Lord and they worshiped. Their initial response was not, "This is a bad idea, Moses." Their initial response was worshiping God. In fact, they only turn negative when things that are negative start happening in their lives. And so when Moses comes before Pharaoh and the Egyptians are upset and they make their work even harder and all of a sudden they have to do more with less and they have to make bricks without straw, that's when they get upset with Moses. And that pattern shows up again. In the desert, when Moses is leading the people, when do they get upset? When they don't know where they're going to find their next meal? When they don't know how they're going to find water to quench their thirst, that's when they get upset. That's when it turns negative because they're focused on the circumstances. Our work is going to be harder. Where are we going to turn? They're focused on these outward enemies. And as soon as they focus on that, they start complaining. I think that's human nature. If I'm focusing on what's out there, something beyond my control, and I start focusing on how negative that is, I'll start complaining. I'll start talking about how things were so much better. And can you imagine? It has not been that long, not even a few days, since they were slaves in Egypt. And they're saying, "Oh, it would have been better if we'd just been back there." Later on in their journey through the wilderness, they'll start to dream about all the food they had in Egypt, conveniently forgetting they were slaves. They were not in control. But it's that human tendency to focus on our enemies, to focus on what's going on around us. And so God is clear, very clear with them, to say, "Focus on me. Focus on my power." In fact, if we see the way in which verse 14 of chapter 14 describes it, as Moses is responding to this, he said in verse 13, "Do not fear, stand by and see the salvation, the deliverance of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever." And here's verse 14. "The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." You get a sense that Moses is telling the Israelites as they're complaining, "You don't understand what you're saying. You need to stay here and be quiet. God has this under control." And so when we focus on God's power, our perspective returns to us. Things start to make a little more sense when we see them through that lens. And that's important. It's important to think about a focus on the fact that this was not a showdown between Egypt and Israel. This was a showdown between Egypt and God. And God was going to show them who was truly powerful. So maybe you're in the midst of some turbulent times right now. Feel like there are some enemies surrounding you. Can I encourage you that if we just focus on those enemies, we're going to feel small, we're going to feel helpless. But if we focus on the power of God, we're going to see how we can make through to the other side, how I can endure this. In fact, it wouldn't be very much longer when the Israelites are going into Canaan. And they'll send in spies beforehand. And as we sing in our Pew Packers group on Sunday afternoons, there were 10 spies who came back with negative reports and 2 who came back with good reports. But as the 10 spies described what it was like to look at the inhabitants of Canaan, they said, "We were like grasshoppers in our sight, and so we were in theirs." They were focused on the enemy. When Joshua and Caleb, the 2 spies who go in, they were focused on the power of God. It makes all the difference in the world for me to focus on God's power. There's something powerful here, too, when we look at the stress God places, not just on His power, but also on glorifying Him. In the midst of turbulent times, I've got to focus on God's glory. God has already said that these plagues in Exodus chapter 12 were a way of asserting His power over these gods of Egypt. Notice what He says is going to happen as He shows His power here at the Red Sea. If you're still in chapter 14, look at what takes place in chapter 18. Here's what God says. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and horsemen. What was the purpose of the Red Sea crossing? It wasn't just to accomplish the fact that God's people needed to get where He was taking them. That was part of it. But what He was doing here was going to show the Egyptians who the true God really was. And that happens because if we keep reading in Exodus 14, in the passage that Josh just read for us, when the Israelites cross through on dry ground and people begin to see what God is doing, notice how they immediately respond. They've been in confusion. God has confused the people that are there. And so they start to flee. They begin to say, this is going to be serious. This is not good. They've been in confusion. And in verse 25, Egyptians said, let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians. The Egyptians knew very clearly what was happening. They weren't under the impression that these Israelites are stronger than we thought they were. They're more powerful than we thought they were. Can you believe they're doing that to us? They knew exactly who was fighting, that God was the one who was fighting on their side. God was being glorified. What happens if in the middle of turbulent times I focus on God's glory instead of my own? What happens if I don't tell myself I can do this, but I tell myself God can do this? And when that happens, when I get through this and I'm on the other side, I'm going to tell people about how God got me through that. Could it be that there's something that you have dealt with, some scars that you have from a previous battle that's been fought, that God has seen you through, and being able to share that with other people, not giving yourself the glory, not telling them, hey, here are the ways to endure it the way I did, but saying, look at what God has done in my life. Could it be that God could use that to reach others, people you may never even have thought could be reached with His message? Is that possible? How can I use what I'm going through to God's glory instead of my own? But then there's also a guidance here that's important. God had already provided guidance. We're going to continue to read in Exodus, if you flip through, about the pillar of cloud that leads them by day and the pillar of fire by night. It was important for them to follow God. It was important for them to listen to God's instructions in the middle of this confusing time. God is the one who confuses the troops of Egyptians when they seem like they're coming up on the Israelites and the cloud is there and there's darkness there and God confuses them. And then when they get in the middle of the Red Sea, God is confusing them there as well. God's the one who's guiding. In fact, He's going to lead His people to Mount Sinai where He gives them a law. Guidance is going to be important. But you know, there are sometimes, Psalm 77 reminds us, where God is working and we don't necessarily know it's happening. Now, there are times when we get specific instructions, like the kind that God gave to Moses. But if you'll notice, He's also using natural elements to accomplish this. Exodus 14 tells us that there's a cloud that God's using to confuse them, that there's an east wind that comes, and through the night, it's that wind that comes and divides the waters. It's not that God isn't doing it. It's not that this isn't miraculous, but God is choosing the elements of the world around in which to accomplish it. In fact, God is choosing Moses and Aaron, human beings, to work. He's choosing Moses, a human guide, to lead them through. There are times God works in ways that we might not completely understand. And I think there's something to the fact that in the 77th Psalm that we just read, we have this reference in verse 19 where He says, your way was in the sea and your paths in the mighty waters and your footprints may not be known. In other words, there are some things that God does that are beyond our understanding. Footprints that may not be known, may not even be seen at times. You may be familiar with the classic kind of Christian writing about the footprints, the poem that describes what it's like to walk through life and you see two sets of footprints as God is with you, and then you turn around and there's just one set of footprints and God says, "It's here that I carried you." Well, in Psalm 77, we have kind of a different twist on that. There are times when I might not see God's footprints. I might not know what's happening. In fact, you may be in the middle of one of those times where things are so turbulent around you and everything's swirling around you, and you just can't see what God is doing through this. I mean, we have His Word, we have this, but everything around us doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I don't know about you, but I can think of times like that where I've searched seemingly in vain to find out, okay, exactly what's happening here? How is God working through this process? Because I'm looking with human eyes, it's going to be hard for me to see that. Sometimes in hindsight, I can look back and I can find evidence of those footprints. I can say, oh, that's okay. God was working through this circumstance. That statement that person told me, that advice I got, that was wise counsel that God used providentially to guide me. But we don't always see it when it's happening. But if we focus on God's guidance, if we focus on what it means to follow Him, even when we can't completely understand or comprehend it, we'll be able to navigate these roaring waters around us. This is a powerful moment for so many different reasons. But one of the reasons it's powerful for Christians is because it is used in the New Testament to describe the Christian's story. And I don't mean story in a fictional sense. I mean a description of what happens in the Christian life. This is a real story that happened to a real group of people. And in a very real way, it describes our Christian walk. In John 8, Jesus would say that those who were listening to Him weren't doing the will of their Father in heaven, but the will of Satan. Because when we are sinning, we're slaves to that sin. That's the same language that shows up in Romans chapter 6 when Paul describes that idea of being enslaved by sin. There's only one way we can be delivered. The Egyptians were enslaved by their captors. There was only one way that they could be delivered. That is, God took the initiative. God came to them. And how was it that they were able to go through to the other side of the Red Sea? Because God's power made that available. They still had to walk through. They still had to follow up on that, but it was God's power that was at work here. And I think that's why when we get to the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when Paul talks to the church there as he's writing, he points to this passage in the Old Testament and says, verse 1, "I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud." We mentioned the cloud earlier. "All passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them." That rock was Christ. What is Paul doing here? He's saying, you know what happened in Exodus? You know what happened when they went through the sea, where they're completely surrounded by water? It's like that was a baptism, and they were following Moses. We get a picture there of what happens when we're baptized into Christ. Now, we've already looked at the book of Hebrews in previous weeks, where Jesus is described not just as Moses, but as one better than, greater than Moses. The Israelites had Moses to guide them through that baptism of the Red Sea. We have Jesus as our mediator. And when we're baptized into Christ, we're not following a human guide. We're following the Son of God. Now, there's something significant that happens when they cross the Red Sea, because up until that point, they'd seen the plagues and they'd known God's power, but they'd been in Egypt, they'd been enslaved. Only when they go through the Red Sea have they left that slavery, and they've left the Egyptians behind. And that's the way in which it's supposed to work in our Christian life. When we're baptized into Christ, we're putting to death that old life, we're leaving it behind. We're starting to live a new life. I don't know what you're struggling with this morning. I know it can be difficult to feel like you're in a country where no one speaks your language. Can I tell you this morning, God is fluent in the language of our griefs, not only because He created us and knows us, but because Jesus experienced them. And because of that experience, we have a mediator that's greater than Moses. We have one to guide us that will never lead us astray. This morning, I would encourage you to focus on God's power. I can't overcome my sin problem. Only God can do that. Focus on God's glory. He's the one that deserves all the credit for what happens in our lives and in the life of this congregation. And focus on God's guidance. It may be this morning you need to be baptized, that you need to leave that slavery to sin to a new life of freedom. Or it could be that you're struggling with what the Israelites often struggled with. They often dreamed about what it was like to be back in Egypt and lost their focus. If you need to put Christ on in baptism this morning to become a child of God, if you need the prayers of this congregation, if you'd like to pray with a couple of our elders right after this worship service, right out that doorway, there'll be a couple who'd love to sit down and to pray with you and to talk with you about how they can encourage you. But it may be you'd like all of us to do that. Let's make sure that we leave here knowing that God speaks our language and that we want to live for Him. If we can help you in any way, please come as we stand and as we sing together.